Alright, so here we go. This is Carpool Conversations. I'm Mark.
And I'm Jim.
And this isn't bullshit. We are actually in a car driving on our way home because we have nothing better to do for an hour and a half, or however long it takes.
And seeing as we're always the smartest people in the room, we thought we'd better record our ideas and thoughts.
I think that was just natural.
Yeah.
I think it just had to happen. So I know Obamacare is going to hell in a handbasket. I know the Ukraine is about to explode. I know Harry Reid is still a scumbag, but all of that has been rendered meaningless with the casting of Star Wars Episode 7 today. Jim, what are your thoughts on this?
I can't wait. That actually is pretty exciting.
Well,
except for the fact that they're all 70 years old.
They did look a little decrepit, but
you know, getting Sir Alec Guinness in there is going to be a bit of a challenge.
He was there. It was a skeleton in the corner. It just dusted off his bones, stuck him in there. I told you I saw the R2-D2 in the back, and they said Kenny Baker's in this, and I thought, oh my god, they shove his pork into the goddamn thing.
Yeah, for the reading, he has to be in the suit for the reading.
So what is your big fear for this movie?
Oh, that it sucks. I mean, we've lived through the prequels, and as any Star Wars geek gets jazzed up about the next movie, that's always going to be hanging over their head. Is it going to suck? I mean, obviously, everything we're being told is that Lucas is not at the helm of the story. So, can someone else step in and have the freedom to write something good and actually be a creative force that puts something together that makes sense, and some other director is going to step in and be able to take that vision and make it something more than just a blue screen theatrical dumpster fire.
Well, speaking of dumpster fires, did Star Trek Into Darkness make any goddamn sense? I submit to you that it did not. I'm not certain what direction that was going in. I have no idea. What I mean,
well,
you got Khan comes out. He goes,
"My name is Khan,"
and everybody's like, "Yeah, okay." Let me go get my encyclopedia. I have no idea.
I felt like they pissed on me. I felt dirty. I felt so angry at the nonsensicalness of the story. That the story did not really have anything going for it other than they just wanted to have a bunch of nods towards the Star Trek canon. And then they pissed me off royally with the whole Spock watching Captain Kirk die in the radiation. I knew what was coming. I knew it was coming, that he was going to look towards the stars with clenched fists and yell, "Khan!
Khan!"
Just like Captain Kirk did in the first go-round.
In
Wrath of Khan. Yeah. And so they did the old switcheroo, and now it's in the alternate universe. Kirk is in there, and we have to relive this whole thing. And it seemed trite and forced. And I knew Spock was going to say it, and I was still yelling at the TV screen, "Don't you fucking say it!" And sure enough, he said it, and I was hanging by a thread, and at that moment, they lost me.
But here's my problem with J.J. Abrams' Star Trek. it seems to be going through all the Star Trek tropes. You know, it's like he's going through a checklist. Do you have the colored uniforms? Check. Do you have Khan in there? Check. Do you have the Enterprise? Check. Do you have, does he have yelling Khan? Yes. Do you have somebody dying? Check.
Right. Even in the first one, you had the guy in the red uniform.
Dying.
As they're jumping to the nonsensical drill. It's like he's got the checklist and he's wanting to, I've got to make all the Star Trek geeks happy, so we got to throw in all these iconic things. And the fact that he threw in the Tribbles, I think, was just like, now you're just really just peeing on us, because it made no sense.
The Tribble was the magic blood.
Yeah.
The sprinkled the cop blood out there.
Something that an episode that was actually meant to, at least the way I took it in my younger age, was kind of almost lighthearted and you know, just you had these little furry things, and it wasn't a very serious episode. And now you're just kind of taking this idea and throwing it in there, and now it has some super magical powers, and it's integral to the really somber, heavy.
I get you. The problem is, it's like, well, we got to have these tropes in there without understanding what Star Trek is really all about.
Yeah.
They weren't trying to make tropes in the original one.
No.
They made a classic movie that had some moments that stuck with you. You make your own damn moments.
Yeah.
So here's what I'm worried about with Star Wars, is that's what we're going to see. And in fact, I would say George Lucas,
sure,
he did that. We've got to have lightsabers, we've got to have spaceships, we've got to have firefights.
Those movies really did not feel like Star Wars movies, but it was, they were Star Wars movies because they had guys with lightsabers.
Yeah. And so, you know, part of me is looking at this picture I'm seeing, Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill and Harrison Ford all in the same room, and they're going to get to work on a new Star Wars movie. The inner geek in me is squealing.
Yeah.
Squealing with delight.
Yes.
I'm having, you know, an insane, my brain can't comprehend
this.
Right.
Are we going to have growth of the characters like we did from A New Hope to The Empire Strikes Back to The Return of the Jedi, where the characters actually have arcs across those, or are we going to have just let's just throw the character in there because it's an iconic character, like you have Spock in the Star Trek, the Return to Darkness, or whatever the hell it's called.
Well, Abrams has made some successful movies. He's made very successful movies.
Yeah.
The question is, are they good movies? I mean, I don't think time has been very kind to the original Star Trek, which was, I really liked the first time around. But its cracks start to show tremendously the more if you've gone back and looked, like all the coincidences and all this other stuff.
As a product.
It feels like a product.
It's very dated.
And so, I'm talking about Abrams' first Star Trek.
Okay.
I don't think that thing is held up. So
no.
I'm asking you, what has been a good J.J. Abrams film? I go on the internet here. Let's take a look here at his filmography. I mean, people were upset with Lost, you know? I know people liked Alias. I never saw it, so I don't have any idea what the fuck happened in that show. But he's doing a lot of TV here. Let's see, I'm looking at a producer. I don't care about what he produced. I want to know what he directed. Okay, so Star Trek Into Darkness, Super 8. That movie was so disjointed. It's like, is it a monster movie or is it an E.T. movie? Screw it, we'll do both.
Yeah.
That was weird.
To be honest, I got bored and I stopped watching it, and so I really didn't see.
He did Mission Impossible 3. I think it was fine.
Yeah.
But he didn't write it. I think, let me check here. I believe Brad Bird wrote that. Well, no, it says he did write it. So there you go.
You know, that one actually surprised me. I didn't remember that he did Mission Impossible 3. Because Mission Impossible 3 is actually a rather bland. It's not a bad movie, but it's kind of a bland movie.
I think it's elevated by Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yes.
I think it's tremendously elevated by him. So, you know, what are you gonna say? I mean, he doesn't have that big of filmography. He's done a lot of TV, and I'm looking at this going, is this really going to be, does he really get the, the essence of Star Wars? And hell, if George Lucas doesn't get the essence of Star Wars anymore,
right.
How the hell is anybody, I wish Mr. Plunkett was directing Star Wars at this point.
Well, you ain't getting sent a pizza roll, you got it?
Well, and I think a lot, so... When you say the essence of Star Wars, I don't think it's a very elusive thing. And if they're paying attention to how the original fans ended up having a huge backlash towards the prequels, then it shouldn't be that elusive for them to figure out, okay, let's at least have an idea of why the first three movies were iconic, and they touched the viewer and they really connected with the viewer. And I think George had an idea of how he wanted to take it and where he wanted to go and how he wanted to tell the story, but none of those things incorporated the original story's ability to connect with the audience. And so I guess all I'm trying to say is, it's not that magical. It's not that complex of a thought when you say the essence of Star Wars. It's a very simple formula in my mind. Good versus evil.
True.
You know, a little bit of redemption. A little bit of belief in yourself. You have very identifiable characters that are growing up, that are growing beyond themselves and accomplishing cool feats.
One of the things, and I'll reference this a lot, people, if you're listening, you want to go to redlettermedia.com. Jim and I are huge fans, and if you haven't gone and listened to the Plunkett reviews, you need to get your head checked. But he says that the one good thing about the prequels is that they didn't rape the Millennium Falcon. It didn't get ruined. It's going to be in the new series. You know, Han Solo and the Millennium Falcon may get ruined. I mean, Han shot first. There's some people that say that ruined, but I don't really think so. It was just one scene, and it was really that ruined George Lucas, as far as I was concerned.
Right.
That's was the first moment when we started to realize that George Lucas may be clinically insane. But now it's all new, and we're gonna have an old Han Solo running around in the vest.
Right.
With the walker and a laser gun.
And who gets to decide the growth of that character from where we last saw him and the lovable rogue who did shoot first in the first movie?
Yeah.
He was in a situation, it was do or die. And he got out alive. So we start off with this rogue. And last we see him, he's helped the rebels defeat the Empire. And so now we're so many decades later. Who gets to decide how that character's arc has gone up until this next episode. And that person really gets to decide if we've screwed over Han, if we've and it probably the same person, ultimately the same person is going to decide, oh yeah, let's tweak the universe and make the Millennium Falcon do this now. Just, you know,
Do you think it should be Harrison?
I don't know.
I mean, Harrison's the guy who came up with the line, I know.
I love you.
I know.
On the other hand, Harrison Ford looks like a grumpy grandpa in just about everything, and he looks like he just doesn't even want to be there most of the time, except for 42. He put his all in 42.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I mean, he just looks like he doesn't give a crap anymore.
If we have the same disjointed approach to, hey, let's do something new with the universe, like we had where R2-D2, now in the very first episode, now has the jetpack and can fly. So where the hell was that in the first three movies?
Well, the warranty ran out.
Well, yeah.
He was 20 years older.
That's right.
This thing had busted. Yeah. You know, I mean, I can't even keep my laptop for more than a couple of years. You think the jets on R2-D2 are gonna last 20 fucking years?
Right.
And there's your explanation. See, it's as easy as that.
Right, but that will not explain. It's very good. I can live with that actually. If that was an actual explanation that someone, that George had tried to wedge in there somehow. But now we've got the opposite thing happening. You've got the Millennium Falcon, which is kind of portrayed in the original three as this heap of junk that can, you know, when it comes down to it, put in between a rock and a hard place, it can get you out of some real jams and do the light jump to light speed.
Right.
Now this old piece of junk is going to be in episode 7, and so now again we're decades later.
Well, you know,
and what is it?
And now Han has been putting shit on that ship since he got it. He's been adding and tinkering to it. So chances are we're gonna see some shit slapped onto it. My guess is they're gonna put a Star Trek nacelle on there or something ridiculous.
Right.
And just, yeah. What, you're just gonna look and go, what the fuck? I don't know. I'll give him credit. I like the new Enterprise. I did like the new Enterprise. I still don't think that any Enterprise has matched the clean sweatback lines of the first movie Enterprise.
Sure.
The show had, you know, set the template, and you got to give it that. But I think that it peaked with the movie's Enterprise. The angular nacelles, the sweatback lines, the glowing dish. They took all the basic pieces and they made it probably as best as it's ever looked. Never liked the next gen Enterprise that much. I love the interior, but I didn't like the squished. I grew to like it. I grew to appreciate it, but I never liked it that much. The next gen movie Enterprise looked like a dart or something. I mean, it was barely a passing resemblance to me. And
sure.
In you know, Star Trek anymore, and then the new one came out and it looked, it was a little different. It had the rounded nacelles, but it had kind of the same dish and the glowing. And I thought, you know, it was the one thing I felt they kind of harkened back to a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, some purists, nerds will tell you that it's way too big and everything else, and you know, I'm like, yeah, probably. I'm more concerned about Spock running after people screaming and beating people in the face endlessly than I am about whether the Enterprise is too big or not.
Yeah.
But so getting back, will Abrams do a good Star Wars? I believe we've come to a definitive answer of we don't fucking know.
Yeah. No, I don't know if there's any definitive way, like you said, to predict what we're going to see. And it comes down to, I think, what virtues do they hold when it comes to what we all hold so dear, which is the idea, what you call the essence of Star Wars. And do they want to change some of those iconic things? And it's okay to change icons if it makes sense, if it grows them or it fits with a concept of whatever it is. But going back to your example, the Millennium Falcon, if it's still kind of this thing that people look at and go, gosh, what a piece of junk, but it still does cool things and has cool things, and Han and they've gone in and they've modified it to do whatever new thing, that's fine. I can live with that. I can accept that. But if it's now this revisualized, enhanced, super freighter,
yeah,
that doesn't even resemble what it used to look like, I think we'll be pissed off.
Yeah, if they turn the interior into the Hilton or something,
yeah,
it's gonna be like,
ugh. Yeah.
Okay, so I think we've rammed that to the ground.
Yeah, I think that, yes, that horse is sufficiently dead.
Yeah. So, moving on, this is a political blog. Those of you who are not familiar with it, it's conservativeyoda.blogspot.com. We both write articles on it, which means I write 272 and he writes one. But it was a good one. I'll give you that. So you can follow us on Twitter, and we'll put it all up there on the website. But this is a political blog, so we probably should talk about politics. So Obama hits a new job approval low. This is not in just some, Rush Limbaugh poll. This is in the ABC Washington Post poll. They prefer a Republican Congress to check Obama's power, and he's down to 41%, which is an absolute low in that poll. So my question to you is, why is the country becoming more racist? I mean, when did this happen that they started hating black people so much? I just don't understand. All of a sudden, it's just, and every day a new poll comes out and says, you know, I'm hating black people even more than I was before.
Yeah.
Strange, isn't it?
And I you know, I have no love for the media. And so I thoroughly suspect that that's going to start creeping in to the discourse, that those poll numbers somehow are affected by a divisive racism that is being generated by the right. And the fact of the matter is, you look historically at two-term presidents, they have a sharp decline in approval ratings in their second terms. I don't really remember what Reagan's poll numbers were.
I didn't think about it, but
he was going through
Iran-Contra,
and so even though I don't remember off the top of my head, I got to think there was a lot of negativity towards Mr. Reagan and his administration. We all know that Slick Willie had his issues second term, and people were not too happy with him, and you know, they again, the same thing with George. His second term.
George's second term in 2006, if you remember the midterms, that's when we lost Congress.
Right.
So in 2007, they immediately raised the minimum wage, and they started, even though Bush in 2004 had said there's a housing crisis coming, and Congress started talking about it, they did nothing, called him a bunch of racists because the guy that was running Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac at the time was black. So, of course, it was only because Republicans are racist. Sure enough, the housing crisis happened. The minimum wage is That was what it always does. Screw everybody out of jobs.
Right.
And, but the truth is, people were disillusioned with Bush by that time. The war, you know, right or wrong, it sank his presidency, or at least sank his second term quite a bit.
Right.
Even though the surge worked, even though some other things worked, you know, it's not like it's atypical or something.
Right.
He lost the second term like we expected
and,
he would.
And I think it's, for a variety of reasons, it does seem to happen that a president's second term, he's going to have poor poll numbers.
True. So.
And so now that we've got that out there.
His poll numbers generally lower. I don't think 41%. I mean, that's bad.
Yeah.
That's Obamacare.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be Obamacare. And, you know, say what you will. I mean, you know.
I would say it's probably a pile of things. The Obamacare being one of the most recognizable and the most the largest of the issues that people are having to deal with on a day-to-day basis. But that being said, I think people are there's a minority of people that are still wanting answers on Benghazi. I think there are plenty of people that are really upset. Again, maybe another minority slice of America, and maybe just conservatives, mainly conservatives, but anyone who has any concept of individual freedoms should be absolutely insanely mad about the whole IRS targeting of groups that don't agree with a certain ideology.
I think all of that adds up to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But quite frankly, it's people. It's the economy, stupid.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, the current job market.
That old chestnut.
Yeah. Well, here, you know, listen to this. It was only in March that the private sector employment surpassed the former peak reached in January 2008, or 51 months from its February 2010 nadir. During the 1981-82 recession, by contrast, it took private sector employment just 10 months to surpass its old high. Now, if current jobs recovery has been as robust as the ones during the Reagan and Clinton years, we would have about 6 million more private sector jobs right now. And it isn't just the quantity of jobs created, but the quality. So the National Employment Law Project found that during the labor market downturn measured from 2008, January 2008 to 2010, employment losses occurred throughout the economy. But the recovery measured from February 2010 to February 2014, employment gains have been concentrated in lower wage industries. Lower wage industries constituted 12% of recession losses, but 44% of recovery growth. Whereas higher wage industries constituted 41% of recession losses, only 30% of recovery growth. Meaning that people are getting jobs, again, but you're getting the minimum wage, the low wage jobs, they're taking pay cuts.
Yes.
And if you were making X amount of dollars, you know, in 2008, you were making $100,000 in 2008, you're making $75,000 now. And you're looking everywhere, and you can't find anything. And the natural human instinct is to point the finger of blame. Whoever's in charge is going to get it.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with Republican or Democrat, quite frankly.
Agreed.
The vast majority of people just aren't that ideologically inclined. They should be. They should know more, but they don't. I mean, we've talked about it. I could go through reams and reams of videos about it. We all know about, you know, Obama money. And whatever the reason, people are not educated where they need to be. And I don't think it has anything to do with the fact that the government and the Democrats actually run the education system. I think that's a coincidence. I don't know. What do you think? I think that's completely coincidental that people are completely uninformed about politics in America. But
yeah, I don't think this is anything new. This is people are interested in navigating their day-to-day life.
Yeah.
And that's where the majority of their focus lies. And when they have the feeling, when they have the perception that their day-to-day life is being disrupted by external forces, then that's when they start to spew and spout off about, we need to change these external forces that are messing with my life. Now, the problem, I think, the problem from my perspective is that how those people educate themselves as to what is really causing the disruption in their life. And it's very easy for them to flip on the TV and listen to a talking head tell them that it's the XYZ party that's causing that disruption.
That's only the Fox News viewers. MSNBC viewers are very enlightened, and they understand everything. That's and right. They don't need to listen to anything else. They got it all figured out.
Right.
But the Fox News viewers, they're a bunch of yahoos and rednecks and stupid people, and they're very prejudiced, and they make stereotypical judgments on people all the time. I know. Have you ever met a Fox? No, I haven't. But I know. I've read Think Progress and the Daily Cause every day, and they tell me exactly what I need to know about that.
What I need to think. I mean, what That's I
right.
need to know.
That's right. Now, shut up. I gotta go watch Honey Boo Boo.
If your main funnel for information is the television set, then look, there are people that get it right, and there are people that get it wrong on the TV. I think the majority of people that are on the TV get it wrong, or are throwing misinformation, or are spinning it to an advantage that they're not really talking about. And at the end of the day, it comes back to how are individuals educating themselves as to what is causing the disruptions in their lives. And if things are disrupting their life, from one end of the spectrum, as drastic as losing one's job, to, oh shoot, you know what, I have to pay a little bit more in property tax, or, you know, there's the ouch that hurts to, ow, I'm really in pain and I'm distressed. Whatever is causing that disruption, it's easy to flip on the television and try to just latch onto the first thing that says, this is happening because of this president or this Speaker of the House or this. And the reality is, who has the most control over the disruptions of your life? You do.
Yeah. You don't ever point a finger at yourself. You need to have blame.
Exactly.
You need to blame somebody.
You need to blame somebody. Now, we can definitely talk about how things like Obamacare are causing, it's back to what we always talk about on our rides to and from work. It's the basic economic principle, the law of unintended consequences. And people have been shouting from the rooftops from day one about Obamacare and the unintended consequences that will fall out of implementing it. And that has fallen on deaf ears, and people have not, they've not educated themselves as to what's going to happen. And people have said, guess what? The quality of care is going to go down. The price of what you pay is going to go up. But we're seeing the fruits of that come to bear. And as we look at the numbers, even the glory, hallelujah, 7 million, the whole idea of this was to get people that were uninsured insured. Have we even begun to approach that goal?
Well, it turns out the 7 million, there's still a lot of questions on that one. But, you know, fortunately, the Republican Congress is getting right to work on this by going after an immigration deal. So, you know, that should fix it, I would think. I don't know for sure. If you ever get to Ace of Spades, I highly recommend it. But I did see a story on there today that I enjoyed. Female performance artist shocks the art world by staging an event that doesn't involve her vagina at all. No, kidding. Of course it involves her vagina. Because, I'm not going to go reading in this story, but I have noticed that the liberal woman is more obsessed with her own vagina than men are with their cocks. You know, men, they talk, yeah, that's saying something. They always talk about how men, you know, all they care about is their, you know, their name it, and all this other stuff. Always like, you know, the reason why is because it's exposed and vulnerable, and if you've ever been kicked, you start paying more attention to it. But beyond that, most men really don't care that much. We really don't. But for some reason, the liberal woman, it's like there's a big empowering thing. I don't understand it. I don't care about it.
It's because you don't have a vagina.
Yes, of course. But, well, I'm a hater. That's what it is. I'm a hater.
I guess so.
So I don't understand because I am a hater. What I get tired of, and I brought this up on the blog, and you people can just go find it, okay? I'm not going to read out every single link that I got, but this is about courage, okay? And what we consider courage today. You and I have had some discussions about that, but I think it bears repeating. We got these people out there. It was a football player and his model wife, his supermodel wife, and she's pregnant. And they did a photo spread of her in like a bikini with her belly out, and he was with no shirt on. And they talked about how the reporter was gushing about how brave they were to embrace their body image, for her to embrace her body image. I'm like, oh yes. How courageous to sit there and get paid probably tens of, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars, at least tens of thousands of dollars, and get all kinds of publicity for people to look at them. I don't know how they withstood the onslaught of apathy that probably came their way.
Yeah.
But this is courageous.
I don't know how many times I walk around during the day seeing pregnant women just angry at them for being in public.
Yes. And how you know,
but
embracing your body image is not courage.
Having seen that picture of those two, now I understand the courage it takes for people to for women to go out in public. In their fraternity.
Well, and he's an NFL football player. She's a model. They got money out the ass. They can do whatever they want. Nobody's going to say boo to them. Everybody fawns over their every word. Oh, yeah, that took a lot of courage. Well, whoop-de-doo, you know? And right now, courage, the biggest onslaught a liberal has is a Christian with a raised eyebrow going, really? That's it. That's the worst oppression they've ever seen. Now go to Burma and see oppression. Go to Iran and see oppression. Otherwise, shut up. I am so over the false courage that I keep hearing about all the time. It's not courage to do a magazine spread and get well paid for it in your underwear. No courage in that anymore.
Right. And I'm sure they walked away from it thinking it was a very humbling experience.
Oh, I'm sure they did. I'm sure they did. You know, when, nobody, most of these people, I mean, the pressure, this golfer, the pressure. You stick a ball in a hole. I mean, the task is couldn't be simpler. You know, you couldn't do what a middle manager does or what a standard computer programmer has to do, the complexity of what goes on into those sorts of things. I wish my daily tasks involved sticking a ball in a hole, if that's all it was, or throwing a ball to another guy, or catching a ball that was thrown at me. If that was it, the pressure. Well, that's okay. Millions of people are watching you. I get it.
Yep.
There is that part of it.
Yeah.
But you get paid handsomely for it. Right. I mean, you're right. Set. And even if you fail, you got a contract.
Here's the thing. I think maybe this is where the pressure comes from, and maybe why it's hard for the normal person to understand the pressure that they think they feel, or some of them feel.
Sure.
It's that they don't have any other skills. Now, let me be...
That would take us back to vagina lady here.
Let me be very clear. The skills that the elite athlete has is impressive. And I celebrate and admire those physical talents. Because that's awesome. I wish I had physical talents. I would be able to do that. But I think when you talk about pressure, the guys that are separated by feeling the pressure and not feeling the pressure... When you've got a Joe Montana that is in the same exact spot where they're down by so many points and it's the last drive, and you know, we've heard the stories time and time again about how he makes the throw to Dwight Clark in the back of the end zone, and during that drive he's running into the huddle with a big smile on his face talking to their guys about, isn't this so much fun? He absolutely feels no pressure, and he goes out there, makes the biggest throw of his life, and the place goes, San Francisco goes nuts, and they win the game. And you got some guys that just absolutely feel the pressure. Why do they feel the pressure? It's because maybe they don't have any other talents or skills other than those physical things that they're on display.
The actual act of going out there and doing the game, when you got millions of dollars on the line, when you got a stadium of 80,000 people, and you know you're on TV with millions of people watching you, okay, I can see it, there's pressure. I don't want to minimize
it. Yeah, no.
But I'm going to take it back to this lady who basically just did a thing of her vagina, and or the football player, the model, going out and just doing a photo spread.
Right.
There's no courage or pressure in any of that.
No.
And you know... If you sit there and question, well, what good is a big giant, you know, mock-up sculpture of your vagina? Why is that art? Well, you know, they get all huffy and arrogant with you don't know. It's like, yeah, I don't know. This is silly. I mean, it's doing things with your body parts. I'm sorry, it's the lowest common denominator. Anybody can do it. And I'm, you know, to me, art is something that actually took work, took time. And, you know, paintings of trees, of still lifes, making it look like something, putting your own spin on it. I mean, do we think that this giant red vagina sculpture is going to go down in history among the great works of Da Vinci or Michelangelo? Or no, it's not. It's just look at me shit.
Yeah.
It's self-involved,
sure.
Perpetually outraged look at me shit. And it gets old real fast. Everybody's done it at this point. So, beyond that, I think we're just about home. So, if you're wondering how long the trip is, it's actually an hour and 15 minutes. And we've only talked for about 45 of it. So, we're going to have to work on that.
Have we said anything?
I think we've said absolutely nothing. Nothing of value.
It feels like I've just rambled.
I have. If those of you who are listening, we have just wasted 45 minutes of your life, and you can never get that back. And we're pretty pleased with that. If we've done that much, if we've caused your soul to die just a little bit, I think we've done our
job. Well done.
I think so. So But if you feel inclined, we'll try to have more of these. And thank you very much for listening.